I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land I'm recording from. I pay my respects to the Wurundjeri Woi Wurrung people of the Kulin Nation and their elders past and present. I also acknowledge the traditional owners from all Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander lands you're listening from.
My grandma tried to teach me piano, but I couldn't. I think there were too many slaps on the wrist. I wasn't living up to her exacting standards. So she had a friend who was actually a piano teacher. And then her husband, he and my CEO, they would just sort of sit in the drawing room while we were doing the lesson in the piano room. And I always remember the curtains were drawn. They'd just be sitting in the dark with a whiskey each, and they're just sort of sharing war stories from their old lives.
You might know comedian Suren Jayamana from his appearances on the ABC's Question Everything, Good Tucker on SBS, or if you have a really keen eye, you might have spotted him in the Marvel film Thor, Love and Thunder. When he was a kid, he'd most likely be spotted in the back of the car soaking up the worldly wisdom of his Sia and Archie, that's his grandfather and grandmother, during school pickups and drop-offs. Suren's grandparents' life in Australia revolved around the three C's: church, cricket, and chess. You could probably stretch that out to six C's. There was also their cabinet full of fine whiskey and the classical music ringing out from Archie's baby grand piano, plus the cliches they loved to drill into their grandson's vocabulary. Although comedy didn't quite make the cut, there was certainly laughter and joy. And why wouldn't there be? Sia and Archie spent their golden years helping raise their grandkids after the whole family crisscrossed the world on a journey that started in Sri Lanka and ended in Melbourne. Suren, let's go back to school. Your lessons would begin before you got to the classroom, in the car with your dad's parents, your Sia, your grandfather, and your Archie, your grandmother. What was their lesson plan?
So essentially every day they would take me to school, and it was literally a lesson plan. I remember there were like folders, like those A4 kind of ring binders with like maps of the world, and they would test me on like the capital cities. There's two more C's for you, capital cities of like different countries. They would just be a flag and they'd be like, what's the capital? There would be like the proverbs, the cliches they love to test me on. And then times tables. They were big on times tables. So I was, I was very precocious little child at primary school, Lizzie. It's embarrassing to think about it now.
Tell me about the cliches they loved. Were there any that stuck with you?
Yeah. The one that really has stuck with me the most, I think, is a stitch in time saves nine. They drilled that into me. And I was thinking about this recently, like, I don't know, in my sort of late 30s now, you start to reflect on life and the meaning of what everything, all your experiences and what's going on. I can think of like a few examples in my life, particularly our little rescue dog that we have at home. He's a scavenger. He's anything and everything. Sometimes he's pulling out like roast Coles chickens out of the bush. And the other day he found like a whole Mars bar. And we didn't know what it was. I just had this instinct instantly that this was terrible. Just some instinct in me, the stitch in time saves nine kicked in. We went to the vet and the vet like brought it up, and it was crazy. There was a whole Mars bar in there. They found like a bone that looked like a breastbone from a chicken in there. There was like a kidney bean in there. I don't even know where the kidney bean came from. When it happened, I was like, this is drummed into me that like this problem, if we don't deal with it now. And it was like about $400 or whatever to make him vomit. That could have been thousands, you know? So a stitch in time saves nine. I think it's good advice.
Saves lives.
It saves lives.
Your grandparents saved your dog's life.
I think so.
When you were young, did you know what that meant? Or were you just reciting what they told you?
Yeah, I think you know like the literal explanation, which is that you'll need to put more effort in to fix a problem if you don't deal with it now. You know that, but you don't have the life experience to know it, if you know what I mean. There's heaps of them, though. They always said health first, family second, work third. That was my grandfather's list of where your priorities should lie. And health first is, I feel like, a pearl of wisdom that my grandfather and grandmother imparted to me that just, it has been my approach to life. And I've had a pretty comfortable life, and I wonder if that's why, you know? Yeah.
Your grandparents were regulars on the school drop-off in Melbourne, but they hadn't been in Australia long. How did they end up here?
They grew up in Sri Lanka kind of while it was under, you know, British occupation. I mean, I always think about how those lessons in the back of the car on the way to school, my grandma's English was like perfect Queen's English, you know, and they really impressed upon me the importance of sort of grammar and speaking proper English. Just, it's so funny to me to think of them moving to Australia and just being shocked at this English speaking nation with all the slang around, you know what I mean? They would have been like, this isn't English. But the way that they ended up in Melbourne was pretty much they were living in Bangkok kind of early retirement. And then my dad got offered two postings. He could either go to Canada or come to Australia for his job. He'd studied as an actuary in London. And then when he got offered a job, he chose Melbourne, or he chose Australia, because it was close to Asia. And he thought that would allow some proximity to my parents, to his parents, sorry. By the time I came along, that was when Mum decided she wanted to go back to the workforce and she wanted to study again. And so that was kind of the impetus that pushed my grandparents to relocate to Melbourne. At that time, Melbourne was starting to develop like a little kind of enclave of Sri Lankan diaspora. There was a point when Melbourne was like Colombo outside of Colombo. It had the biggest population of Sri Lankans outside of Colombo.
Did your parents ask them to come out, or did they just do it?
I feel like they just did it. So my dad is an only child. My grandfather loved whiskey and he was very charismatic and he loved his weekends away with the, you know, the boys and stuff. And I think that might have appealed to him, but also family, you know, health first, family second. And so I think they made the choice to come out, and it would have been to be close to us and to be around the grandkids, because it's not like they had other grandkids elsewhere.
Tell me about their apartment in Melbourne.
So they lived in a little unit in like around Glen Waverley. They would have had just a two-bedroom flat. And one of the things I remember most is that my grandma, Archie, she had a grand piano, like a baby grand, and it was just in this tiny apartment, and it would take up most of the living room. And she played piano amazingly. She was a very, very talented pianist. You could hear it from down the street. And I think people did appreciate it. People would be on their walks and they would stop and listen in while she was practicing. She would play Chopin and stuff. So that was one iconic thing that I definitely remember from their unit. And then the other thing was, as they were such avid travellers, they just had so much memorabilia and souvenirs that they'd accumulated over a lifetime of traveling around Europe, around Asia. And the thing that sticks out most in my memory is from their time in Thailand, in Bangkok, they had acquired these caricatures. Like they, you know, those like really exaggerated, like all the features are exaggerated. And it was just my grandfather and my grandma and these two little portraits. And they just were so funny. I think my brother loves drawing and animating, and I think that's probably having a look at those and seeing like, yeah, the giant nose that they put on my grandfather and my grandma's big ears and just like, yeah, that's probably where it's sparked a love in animation for him.
Yeah, a love of animation for him, and maybe a bit of comedy for you.
Yeah, maybe. My grandfather was very funny. He was very charismatic, always the life of the party kind of guy. And I think, yeah, this acquiring these caricatures was part of that. I think he definitely had them on display as like a talking point when people come around.
This apartment in the outer suburbs of Melbourne is a bit of a museum of items collected during their world travels. Why were they so worldly? Where did that come from?
So they spent most of their lives in Sri Lanka, but they did have a little stint in Switzerland. And then also they kind of, I think they were dreaming of retiring in Portugal. And they were living in Bangkok at the time that my parents came to Australia. And I think if my parents hadn't come to Australia, they probably would have lived out their dream of moving to Portugal, because they really loved Europe. And Sri Lanka had its history of different waves of European influence. So first the Portuguese, then the Dutch, and then the English. But like there definitely would have been an attitude amongst some of the more well-to-do class in Sri Lanka, which my grandma's family kind of were, like her father worked at the central bank and stuff. And he worked at the central bank, I think, for like 5 years. He was governor of it and had worked his way up the public service or civil service in Sri Lanka. And then he was even knighted at one point by the Queen. And so I think my grandma's family definitely came from a class that was like proud of being able to integrate with British society and high society, and they liked the finer things in life. And my grandfather, he didn't come from that kind of background, but obviously married into it and worked in his field very hard and enjoyed the sort of relationship part of business and stuff like that. And so I think they were quite lucky in being able to explore that.
So they lived this kind of globe-trotting life, and that was partly because Yosiya worked for the United Nations. What kind of work did he do?
So kind of, I guess, enterprise bargaining and like, yeah, kind of labor union stuff, but he was on the employer side. That was his career in Sri Lanka. And from that, Dad said he used to like, most of it was just relationships, like going away for weekends with different people. And he got to know all the union managers, and it was all like, yeah, friendship and camaraderie and negotiations, but like achieving, you know, amicable outcomes through whiskey, I guess. And then from there, he found this role in the United Nations kind of international labor organization, which was on the other side. So he was now part of the union side, but they would do work with different countries setting international standards.
So they have this, you know, expat life overseas, and then they move to Melbourne. When they weren't ferrying you kids around Melbourne, how did your grandparents spend their days?
As I said, my Archie loves piano. They also became part of the church very quickly. So my grandma was raised Baptist, I think, but when she met Sia, he was Catholic, and she converted to that, and she kind of took the mantle from there. Like, I think she was very devout, so she was very involved in the church. She was involved in the choir and would sing at the church. I always remember going to church every Sunday, and sort of like she would, when she wasn't in the choir, she'd be sitting with us, and she would sort of like push the hymn book towards me and try to get me to sing, and I was always mortified, but I could kind of pretend to sing because her voice was so like dominant from the back of the church. But yeah, so I think in terms of how they spent their day, most of it was, apart from looking after us, was socializing with this community of Sri Lankans who had retired here. And I remember every Tuesday I used to go for piano lessons. My grandma tried to teach me piano, but I couldn't. I think there were too many slaps on the wrist. I wasn't living up to her exacting standards. So she had a friend who was actually a piano teacher, and we would go around every Tuesday to their house. I called her Auntie Anne, and she would teach me piano. And then her husband, who is Uncle Doug, he and my Sia, they would just sort of sit in the drawing room while we were doing the lesson in the piano room. And I always remember the curtains were drawn. They'd just be sitting in the dark with a whiskey each, and they're just sort of sharing war stories from their old lives. But I remember wishing that I was out in the drawing room with like Sia and Uncle Doug and listening to their stories rather than playing the piano.
And drinking whiskey.
Yeah, that would have been nice too. Yeah.
Both your grandparents were born in Sri Lanka. What was your Sia's early life like?
So Sia was born to a family of, it was quite a large family. I think he was like the second of maybe eight kids. And I think they were a pretty working class family, not like in poverty by any means, but certainly not in the same kind of echelon as my grandma's family. But his parents actually had a car accident while he was quite young, and they passed away. And then Sia actually had to then basically raise his younger siblings.
How old would he have been?
I think maybe in his teens, like 15, 16. Yeah. So he was very young, and he had to basically became like the guardian for his younger siblings. My family haven't really gone into too much detail about it, but I think his elder sibling had an issue with gambling, and unfortunately a lot of the inherited money sort of was frittered away. And so the responsibility fell onto my grandfather, and that's, I think that probably shaped a lot of his kind of outlook on life. Those values of family first, or health first and family second, and a stitch in time saves nine, and sort of another one that I often remember is a bird in the hand is worth two in the bush, is another proverb that they always said to me, which means what you have now is not worth giving up because you think that you could get more. So it's sort of like a gratitude thing. I think that would have been quite a character shaping experience for him. And probably in some respects, he had such a joy for life, and his charisma and charm probably came out of the fact that he'd been through something that was like, I imagine once you go through something like that, you're like, what else can life throw at me, you know? And I'm just going to make the most of whatever comes from here. And then from that, you create your own luck and you create your own joy.
He sounds like such a charismatic, jovial, happy-go-lucky kind of guy. Sounds like it would have come in handy when he was trying to impress your grandmother,
yeah.
Archie.
Yeah, I think it definitely would have. She, I mean, they were like, yeah, they were so tight and so close, and definitely like you could, it always felt like the love was there throughout such a long marriage. And my grandma is, as she would always be one to point out, was a very beautiful, very attractive person. I've seen photos of her and her sister when they were sort of in their probably late teens, early 20s, dressed in saris and with like jewelry and whatnot all made up. And they, for the time, I imagine, well, I don't need to imagine because she has told me many times, but they definitely had boys swooning around them. My grandma loved to tell this story of how rickshaws would come past their house and the schoolboys would throw stones at the window to try to get their attention because they were so, you know, they were
beautiful.
The trophies. But yeah, so and my grandma always, again, she comes from that generation, I think, where there was so much pride in appearance and also status, you know, and particularly, again, to go back to like the colonial thing, or like there's no beating around the bush. There was like an essence of trying to live up to these kind of high society standards and to try to bring in the culture and the civilized kind of like British, play into those types of stereotypes. She liked to have the valuable stuff because it was status, but she loved just the costume jewelry, just getting dressed up. Any chance she got, she would put a sari on and like, yeah, even till her late years, like she died in her 90s, she would still wear a sari to church and yeah. And it still looked very, yeah.
She's still just dashing,
yeah.
She knew it too.
Yeah, she knew it. Yeah.
So what did her education look like? You know, she's trying to get ahead, I assume, be more British, which is of the time. Like I relate to that. Like my dad's family was like that too growing up in Malaysia. That's what you did.
Yeah.
Was like try and be English.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what did her education look like?
She really loved the piano. She loved classical music and she wanted to be a professional pianist. And I think she used to mention that her and her sister, who her name was Auntie Soma, they used to play duets together. They would play at church recitals and that kind of thing. And they actually got to the point where they were, I think, accepted into like the Royal Academy of Music in the UK. And so that was like a huge moment for them where it was a real opportunity to go relocate to London to learn and develop their piano. But their father
very stern man, very strict kind of guy. So he never allowed it. And I don't think she ever really forgave him for that. I think she sort of was like, there was always the what could have been if I could have become a concert pianist or something like that. Yeah.
Your Archie's dad sounded like a strict kind of guy. Yeah. How did you see her impress him?
Yeah, I think probably his career, like working his way up through like the civil service and that kind of thing was probably, and I imagine his charisma would have helped.
Yeah.
I imagine he would have charmed him. But also I think probably his story of hardship and coming through that and being jovial and seeing the brighter side in life the way that he did would have put my great-grandfather at ease that he was going to take care of his daughter.
Both your dad's parents sound like well-educated, worldly people, and then your dad ended up moving to London for uni. How did he meet your mum?
Yeah, so dad went to study mathematics, I think, in London. Big nerd. And
nerd gene.
Yeah.
Strong.
Yeah. I mean, he was a competitive chess player in Sri Lanka when he was younger. Mum was a nurse in London at the time. So she grew up in Malaysia. She was born in Malacca in Malaysia. And then back then, I think it was quite common for like skilled migration, again, post-colonial kind of thing, to have a route from Malaysia through to London. And nursing was one of those things. And Mum had grown up loving like Jane Austen. She was educated at like a Catholic convent. And I think the nuns weren't fond of the kids reading books like Jane Austen and stuff like that. She said that she got like caned a couple of times, but she would sort of go and hide and read in the corner. And she was voracious. She absorbed everything that Jane Austen. And I think at a party, someone introduced Dad to Mum. And they probably had a circle of friends that were similar just from both being kind of in this like Sri Lankan diaspora type of community. I'm not sure. I've never actually asked Mum whether it panned out to be the Jane Austen kind of story, whether Dad came in like Mr. Darcy or not.
Oh, Elizabeth, look. It's that handsome Mr. Darcy. Do you think you'll ask him to dance with you?
Well, why not? He is a gentleman and I am a gentleman's daughter. So far, we are equal. Do you dance, Mr. Darcy?
Not if I can help it.
Yeah, I don't know if he would have been quite as dapper as Mr. Darcy. I have seen some photos from that era and he had big thick sideburns and like flares and stuff, which seems so far removed from the man he is today. But so I think he had a bit of style, but yeah, I think they hit it off pretty quickly and yeah, one thing led to another and then it was all of a sudden a choice between Canada and Australia and yeah, here we are.
Did your mum's parents approve of her moving halfway across the world to become a nurse?
I think it was a point of contention in mum's family. So mum's background is Tamil. They're like Sri Lankan ethnicity, but her family, the generation before, had migrated out of Sri Lanka to Malaysia. And so they were Tamil and Hindu and in Malaysia, but, you know, in kind of Tamil Hindu culture in general, it's very much arranged marriages and very much sort of the matchmaking thing sorts that out for you. And then mum went off to London and I think coming home with a Sinhalese fiancé was a point of contention. I don't think it sat too well. I don't think mum's parents really were too fussed, but like the community, those small communities where everyone talks and everyone has an opinion, that it definitely ruffled some feathers, I think.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, Tamil, Sinhalese.
Yeah.
Not arranged
exactly.
Marriage.
Yeah, it's ticking none of the boxes. But
he's Catholic.
Yeah.
She's Hindu.
Exactly.
This is the United Nations.
Yeah. It really is. And it maybe, I mean, it's to me, it's more interesting than a Jane Austen novel, I think.
It is.
I was born after both of my mum's parents had died. And mum, because she was like so into Jane Austen and stuff, and she kind of never really talked much about her Hindu upbringing. She knew that we were going to be raised Catholic. She was very westernized in her tastes and stuff. And so Hinduism never really played a role in my life.
So what was your mum's relationship like with your dad's parents? Did they get on?
Yeah, I think mum, I never really knew how much of an impression my grandfather had left on mum until he passed away. And then I have this vivid memory of at his funeral or the day before his funeral, mum sort of like, in tears, and she wrote a little letter. And then when we were at the funeral, just catching her through the side of my eye at the casket and just pausing for a moment, and she sort of left the note there. And it just sort of dawned on me that I think, again, his wisdom and his sort of that jovial outlook on life, I think it just had such an impact on so many people, and it really felt like she had been so heavily influenced by his gratitude and his joy that I think she definitely took a lot from his outlook on life as well. My grandma and mum, I think there's probably a typical kind of mother-in-law and daughter-in-law relationship, but there was a mutual admiration and respect there, I would say. Yeah, to be diplomatic.
Religion acts as a kind of bridging factor between your parents' families. Your grandmother even converted to Catholicism when she married your grandfather. Clearly, the church was a big part of your life. Tell me a bit about that.
Yeah, we would go every Sunday to church pretty much through my entire childhood. And it was just the done thing. I went to a Catholic primary school, and I remember being like the only kid that went to church from this Catholic primary school. I remember being self-conscious as a kid growing up Catholic, and then just sort of confused why I was the only kid that was at church, but also like, also being brown was kind of strange to me as well. I was like, why? Yeah, how did we end up Catholic and also the only Catholics? But we'd go every Sunday, and part of it was like just a preamble to lunch, you know? Like the tradition was church, and then after church we'd all go to lunch, and it was like just so exciting to be like knowing you're spending the day with Archie and Sia.
Until you're about 15, your grandparents are involved in your day-to-day life. Then Sia goes in for a routine colonoscopy. What happened?
Yeah, so he, I think like a couple of weeks before that, he just had gotten lost. He'd gone out for a walk, and then no one had heard from him for the whole day, and everyone was a little bit frazzled. And he just sort of absentmindedly gotten lost, and out of that, the doctors were like, oh, there might be something underlying this. And so they sent him in for a colonoscopy. And then while he was there at the hospital for the procedure, he got infected with like a staph infection. And then from there, it all happened very quickly. He sort of deteriorated within a matter of days and then unfortunately passed away. But one thing that, I remember very clearly is him sort of having maybe only a couple of hours to go. It was like he was waiting for my dad, and then my dad getting there and saying, it's okay, you can let go now. And then within a few minutes, he was gone. And that, again, I think just speaks to his values and his strength of character of being like just wanting to hold on for that family connection, I think. And almost as well, there's something, I don't know, but there's something about him being in control of that moment, you know, like he was holding on, and then And when the moment came, he made the choice to let go, which I think is a very empowering kind of thought. But yeah, it was the first person in my life that I had known to pass.
So your first death close to you, what did you learn from that?
In hindsight, looking back on it now, I would say it taught me how much someone does stay with you even after they've gone. And it might not be a conscious thing. Like, it's not like I'm always often thinking about my grandparents, but in terms of the way that I live my life, I can definitely see those lessons that we talked about before, that they're still there, that they're drummed into kind of my perspective and outlook on the world. I think I learned more perhaps at the time from how my grandma carried herself rather than from Sia's departure, which was that she'd obviously loved him and he was the love of her life and they had this long marriage. But I think it's quite common for people who have that long marriage when someone passes away for the other partner to kind of go pretty quickly. But she lived after that, I think he died around 2001 and she lived till 2018 and she just like kept trucking.
A few years later, you experienced a very different version of grieving, a grandparent on the banks of the River Ganges in India and a grandparent you'd never even met.
It was the 25th anniversary of my grandparents passing, of my grandma on my mum's side passing. And so mum's siblings kind of arranged this trip to Varanasi in India to like basically do some sort of prayers and rituals to kind of commemorate that 25th anniversary. And it was the first experience I really had with Hinduism. And Varanasi itself is like such a spiritual place. I've never felt anything like it. I remember going there and just being immediately like, I was like, this is something that I will connect with. I just know it. At some point in my life, I will revisit this experience and feeling very caught up in the spirituality. Of course, then I came home and spent the rest of the summer playing video games and forgot about it. But we basically went out at sunrise, had a boat that took us out onto the Ganges. And while the sun rose, a priest was reciting prayers to commemorate the it got a bit weird actually, because I think the priest could tell that most of us were not native speakers. And so he started trying to kind of blackmail us almost, where he was like, hey, if you want your ancestors to have 50 years good prosperity in the afterlife, then you have to pay this much money. But if you want them to have 100 years, and then luckily my auntie speaks like quite well, Tamil. And so she started telling him off and was sort of like, this surely is bad karma for you to be holding us hostage. And then after that, he took us to the temple and he was very nice to us after that. So yeah, but it was, though I never met my grandparents on that side of the family, the connection to Hinduism is something that more recently in life has become quite a big part of my journey. And I think I do feel very grateful to have that connection, even though it's not one that tangibly I never met them, but there's still a legacy there, which is nice.
What would you say your spirituality looks like now?
Well, this is the interesting thing, and it's only sort of like through coming onto this podcast and thinking and reflecting about those proverbs that my Archie and Sia kind of drummed into me. But it really is interesting how much overlap I think there is between those attitudes of gratitude and appreciating what you do have, making the most of something now or like doing the right thing now rather than putting it off. Yeah, I did a show at the Comedy Festival last year that was sort of inspired by the Bhagavad Gita, which is like one of the seminal Hindu texts. And half of that's like a conversation between Krishna and Arjuna, who's like having this crisis. He's meant to be the hero of the story, but he starts to freak out and he's like, I can't do it. And then Krishna, who's God, basically slaps him and tells him gives him these instructions for life. And it's so funny how much of those, I mean, it's obviously just good advice. And so it's maybe it's not that amazing, but it is like, it's like almost like me being in the back of the car getting driven to school was like me being Arjuna while my grandparents were giving me these life lessons, you know, and driving the chariot to school. But it's fun to see the parallel between my Catholic grandparents giving me these proverbs that are like English sayings that they, that part of it was probably just grammar at the time. They're trying to teach me grammar, but then they're these life lessons and values that I hold like 30 years later, you know, and seeing the parallels in Hindu spirituality is a kind of nice, beautiful thing.
That's comedian and famed protagonist of the Bhagavad Gita, Suren Jayamana. Grand Gestures is a Deadset Studios production for SBS Audio. It's hosted by me, Lizzie Hu. The executive producer is Kelly Reardon, supervising producer is Grace Pashley, and producer is Liam Reardon. Sound designed by Jeremy Wilmot. Big shout out to the SBS team for their help, Caroline Gates, Joel Supple, and Max Gosford. Now, you can find Grand Gestures on the SBS Audio app or wherever you listen to podcasts. But you should go one step further. Whip out your phone right now, find Grand Gestures in your app and hit follow. It's completely free and it'll ensure you don't miss an episode.